12:31.
For a trip, or you're going for a really
in your heart, you grow in fire and you much
thank you so much. Can I actually get your email?
It's Judge 5, JUDGE, the number 5, at AOL.com.
Thank you, Robin. Thank you for everything which you told me over the time I was here.
How long have you been here?
Everything's just my second stint. It was 3 months this time, 3 months last time. Around about what
first. What are you going to be doing?
I've gone back to work, please.
What is your field?
Law. Here. I'm working in a corporate at the moment.
Much as well.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, again, we're still continuing with the Aseret HaDibros. We looked at the Zohar versus the Shamor, the difference between Yisro and the Eschanan. Then it goes on, the Torah says, again, we're trying to identify how many commandments. So in the fourth commandment, the fourth statement, remember the day of Shabbos to keep it holy, that is Kiddush and Havdalah. Then it says, 6 days you shall do all of your work, and on the seventh day, it is a Shabbos for Hashem. So one might raise the question, is there a mitzvah to work 6 days a week? Now countless parents have used this verse, if they're a bit biblically knowledgeable. Countless parents have used this verse to try to convince you to leave yeshiva. They say, you know, Torah says 6 days you shall work. But obviously, although it's true that indeed Chazal actually say that there's a mitzvah to work in the sense of being productive, being creative, not stagnating in life, that take the 6 days and use them in a wise way, but it's not basically saying work instead of learn. That's a separate question. That is a, well, I should never say work instead of learn, that's never the issue. One has to learn whatever you're doing, but whether I learn full time, whether I work part time, those are very, very important questions, and maybe we'll spend some time doing that sometimes. But all I can say is, you can't just simplistically answer the question by saying, 6 days you have to work. You know, that obviously, the Torah is not saying you have to. The Torah is saying, for 6 days you do malacha. Now remember what malacha means? Mastery over the natural world. 6 days I exercise my mastery over creation, and on the seventh day, I stop, I withhold. And then the Torah gives you a negative commandment, which is interesting. Although we say Zohar is the positive and Shomor is the negative. But in truth, even in the Zohar commandment, which is the positive, there is a negative commandment. Lo saseh bo malacha. Right? This is a love, not to do malacha on Shabbos. So in that positive, there is a love. This is one of the 365 negative commandments in the Torah, the prohibition against doing malacha on Shabbos. That's fine. But then it gives you a whole list of who is not allowed to do malacha. And let's analyze this. Ata, you cannot do malacha. Bincha, your son, cannot do malacha. Bitcha, your daughter, cannot do malacha. Avdecha, your slave. Right? Now, here's the question. The Torah says you cannot do malacha. Now, what son and daughter is included in the next sentence, or the next words? It can't be a boy that's already bar mitzvah, or a girl that's already bas mitzvah, because they're you. When the Torah says, you can't do malacha, you includes every person who is chayav in mitzvahs. So what is the Torah adding when it says, your son and your daughter? So here we see a very, very important rule, that the Torah actually prohibits a parent to ask a son or a daughter to do malacha on Shabbos. Now, if they're not bar mitzvah yet and they do things on their own, although you're supposed to train them, that's not an issur d'oraisa. It is not prohibited min haTorah for a 2-year-old to turn on a light switch, etc. In fact, even for a 10-year-old, it's not prohibited. But it is prohibited from the Torah for me to ask my child. You know, people sometimes think, let's say the light is off or something, or the Shabbos clock malfunctions. So people sometimes say, ask Yitzi to turn it on or whatever it is. That's an Isser D'Oraisa, because that's what the Torah must mean. The Torah cannot mean a child that is already bar mitzvah, because that would be nichlal in the atah, in the you. So it must refer to children below bar mitzvah. Now this is a general rule. It doesn't only apply to Shabbos. It actually applies to every prohibition. I am not allowed to make my child do an avera. I cannot feed him treif, even if he's 6 months old. Unless it's pikuach nefesh, of course. But if the formula I like has a non-kosher ingredient in it, I am not allowed to feed my baby that formula, unless, of course, as I say, if it's pikuach nefesh. And for infants, we're quite lenient in considering almost every situation potentially life-threatening. So, of course, ask a shayla. But in principle, you cannot give your child non-kosher food, even though if they're eating on their own, they're not doing any aveira. And one of the sources that's derived from there is the idea of Shabbos. Now, so that's son and daughter, right? Yeah.
If your son or daughter turns on the light, you didn't tell them to do so. It's on Shabbos. And then you go to read a book in that room. Can you do that?
Yes. You're allowed to benefit. Well, let me put it this way. So it depends, actually. If they did it for themselves, because they wanted to use the light, you are allowed to benefit. If they did it for you, even though you didn't ask them, let's say they say, you know, Daddy, I want you to do a favor for you or something, then you're not allowed to benefit. So it really depends on the motive. But if they turned it on for themselves, you're allowed to. Now, people always have this question, an interesting question. Sometimes people just hope their child will flail his arms, meaning sometimes you have a situation where you might have a 6-month-old baby, and the baby has no intention to turn on a light, but they say, you know, he likes to wave his arms, so let's bring him to the light switch where he just hits the arm. That's an interesting question. That actually might be permitted, because the baby has no intention to turn on the light. And therefore, it may not be called a forbidden malacha, even. And therefore, as a result, you're just benefiting from the flailing of an arm. But that's very different than a 5-year-old, where you say, hey, you know, turn on the light because it's dark, or whatever it is. Yeah.
So rabbinically, it's allowed as well, right?
To do what? To flailing of the arm?
For a child to switch a light on Shabbos.
Well, let me put it this way. It's an interesting question. Rabbinically, it is allowed for the child, but it is not allowed for the parents. I, as a parent, am supposed to train my child. So I'm not supposed to let my child turn on the light. The child is doing no avera.
Right.
But I'm not supposed to let him. I'm supposed to, if I see that he's about to turn on the light, I should instruct him not to do so.
Because I remember I was at a Shabbos dinner before I came yes. here, and there was one of the children was like pressing the switch like this, and the parents said stop, but they weren't like get. I would have thought like religious parents would go mad about it. So the child wasn't really doing anything wrong.
No, the child was not doing. How old was the child?
Must have been like 5, 6.
Yeah, okay, but the child is not doing anything wrong. But the parents do have an obligation. Now again, if you're a parent, you have to weigh the consequences. Now the parents did say to stop, okay?
Yeah.
Now, the kid doesn't stop. So what am I supposed to do? Am I supposed to go crazy and throw him out of the window? In other words, like this. When you're training a child, right? When you're training a child, you have to be very, very careful that you don't train him in a way that he may hate the Torah, right? So that's why parents have to make a decision. Meaning, yes, I'm supposed to stop my child from doing this, but if I stop him in a way that's going to make him antagonistic, then I've defeated the whole purpose. And so that's why you have to... in other words, it's different. If the child is bar mitzvah, that's a separate cheshbon. Then it certainly is an aveira.
And this is true for all malachas?
This is true for all malachas, yeah. Yeah.
Is it worse to... You know, like some people, they'll try to get around it and they'll try to hint, like, you know, if they're... You know, they'll try to hint to a non-Jew, especially in the United States, or to a little...
Okay, so again, the situations are not comparable, but I'll get to the non-Jew in a second. You know, one is a Jewish child, one is a non-Jew. It is not the same situation. To hint to a Jewish child is much more chamor. You're not allowed to do it. Now, I just want to continue the sequence. So after it says son, daughter, then it says servant, you know, male servant, and female servant, avdecha, Vamascha. Now, what is this referring to? So, this is referring to a non-Jewish servant, because a Jewish servant, an Eved Ivri, is a Jew. So, the Eved Ivri is included in Atah. But there's a big question here. If you have a non-Jewish servant, that's called an Eved Kanani, a Canaanite servant, but it's Lav Dafka Canaanite, means a non-Jewish servant. You know, a non-Jewish servant is partially Jewish. A non-Jewish servant is chayav in the same mitzvos as a woman. And women, of course, are not allowed, you know, they have to keep Shabbos. So why would the Torah command me that I have to let my Eved Kanani rest? Of course I do, because the Eved Kanani is obligated in his own capacity to keep Shabbos. An Eved Kanani has to keep Shabbos. An Eved Kanani doesn't have to wear tefillin because an Eved Kanani has the obligations of a woman. A woman doesn't wear tefillin. But an Eved Kanani has to keep Shabbos. So why would the Torah command me, don't make your Eved Kanani work on Shabbos? That's obvious, because that would be the same thing as making a Jew work. The Torah doesn't say, don't make a Jew work on Shabbos. Because of course I can't make a Jew work on Shabbos, because a Jew can't work on Shabbos. So an Eved Kanani is the same thing. An Eved Kanani cannot work on Shabbos. Yeah.
Yeah. Just a bit off topic, just slightly. So you're taking your non-Jewish servant or slave or whatever it may be, and you're making them keep Shabbos. Is that not a bit akin to a forced conversion?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, it is. But let me explain something about this, because there are certain details that are not that clear even from the Gemara. When I take a non-Jew, of course, slavery by definition is a compulsory relationship. And we could talk about why does the Torah allow slavery? That's a good question. Although I have to say that the slavery of the Torah is far more humane than any comparable slavery that existed in the ancient world, but it does exist. Okay. Now, if I simply buy a non-Jew as a slave, that alone does not impose upon him the halachic obligations of an Eved Kanani. He doesn't have to keep Shabbos under those circumstances. However, in order to make him religiously obligated, he has to have circumcision and immersion in a mikveh. So the interesting interpretive question is that voluntary or is that compulsory? Meaning you have to differentiate between the actual acquisition of the slave and the religious ceremonies that impose the obligations on him. There are some Rishonim who understand that although slavery per se is a compulsory relationship, but the circumcision and the immersion in a mikveh do have to be voluntary. So in effect, if that would be the case, that would answer your your objection, because that would mean we're not forcing him to keep Shabbos. This is a decision he made. Once he's a slave, now, of course, it's a matter of convenience, right? If I'm a non-Jewish slave, I may want to be able to keep Shabbos, because that gives me a day, a guaranteed day off. Now, there is a law in the Rambam. The Rambam says, if I buy a non-Jewish slave, and he refuses to undergo circumcision or immersion, I can only keep him for 1 year and give him a chance. And if he doesn't want to do it after a year, I have to, he's not free, but I have to sell him back to his non-Jewish masters. So there is a bit of pressure there. But the actual conversion process is a voluntary conversion process.
Yeah. What in the case of eunuchs, if you buy a eunuch,
yes,
who's being fully castrated, yes, they can't be circumcised.
So okay, yeah. Yeah, well, okay, a very good question. Well, the way we deal with that is that, well, I mean, it depends exactly. I mean, normally there is a concept of symbolic, just as somebody who was circumcised. We pinprick the area. Of course, if you're talking about a true eunuch where there's literally a castration of... that would be difficult. It may not be possible. According to halacha, it may not be possible to own such a slave, precisely for that reason. But if, for example, he already was circumcised or the like, there's a pinprick of blood that is considered to be
really
okay.
That doesn't really.
Well, normal. A full castration normally does not involve that. Yeah.
And when you said that an Eved Kenani,
yep,
he has to do the mitzvah like a woman, meaning he has to do a Parashat Chala and light candles on Shabbos?
Well, yes, except let me point out that since an Eved, by definition, is a member of his master's household, like anything else, anyone that's a member of a household, the woman lights for everybody. I mean, again, let's imagine a case where a family has, you know, sons and daughters who are living at home. Not everybody has to light candles. The woman lights candles for everybody who's the household. So an Eved would be a member of the household. And by the way, I want to point out another thing. The mitzvah of separating challah from dough and the mitzvah of lighting candles is not only a woman's mitzvah. If you are married, the mitzvah is on the woman to do it. But you know, if you're a single person, you're not in yeshiva. Let's say you had your own apartment. You have to light Shabbos candles. Yeah, there's no rule that Shabbos candles is only a woman's mitzvah. Shabbos candles is a mitzvah for everybody. But if you have a wife, so we give it to the wife. If the wife is not able to light that week, the husband lights, and challah for sure that way. If you happen to bake, some men like to bake. Right? If you happen to knead the dough, and the dough is big enough in quantity, you know, 5 pounds of flour or 2.5 pounds of flour, right? 2.5 pounds, you separate challah without a bracha, and 5 pounds with a bracha. So, you know, a man separates challah. It's not only a woman's commandment. So in theory, yeah, an Eved would have to, but so would any Jewish man as well. So the Gemara actually says the following. The Gemara actually says that, so the question becomes, what is the chiddush of saying your slave cannot do work? Your slave is like a woman. Of course he or she cannot do work. The chiddush is that even if they didn't go to the mikvah, so they're not obligated, you cannot make them do work. So the Torah is telling me a vacation here. The Torah is saying, you, the master, cannot make your slave work on Shabbos even if he has not yet immersed in a mikvah. You have to give him a day off. So it's a totally different twist. It's not referring to the Shomer Shabbos Eved. That would be obvious. It's referring to the Eved who is not a Shomer Shabbos Eved. Now, here, therefore, we have an interesting question. If he's not a Shomer Shabbos Eved because he didn't go to the mikvah, he's a goy. He's a non-Jew. So what are the implications about telling a non-Jew to do work on Shabbos? That's the question. Let's take a very simple question. We've heard this, right? I know you've heard this. You mentioned it already. The light is off. I want to ask a non-Jew, not a Jewish child, a non-Jew, turn on the light for me. So, I know you've heard this, that you're normally not allowed to do it. However, what's interesting is there are a lot of subtleties. even though the Torah prohibits making your slave work on Shabbos, and the slave that the Torah is talking about is a non-Jew who did not go to the mikvah, so he really is a goy, but Chazal differentiate between a slave who is part of your household versus the non-Jew who lives across the street. And min ha-Torah, underline min ha-Torah, you actually are allowed to ask a goy to do work for you. It is not an Isser D'Oraisa, but the Chachamim prohibit it. So it's not in this commandment. The Chachamim Midrabanan prohibited asking a non-Jew to do anything that you're not allowed to do yourself. Okay, and this is the meaning of the statement, Amira la'oved kochavim shavus. Saying to a guy to do malacha, shavus. Shavus means a rabbinic prohibition. It's not a Torah prohibition. Now, let me point out, this is a very complicated area of halacha. Let me just say there are two different components of this law. Component number one is you don't ask a guy to do work for you. Component number two, even if he did it on his own, without you asking, if he did it for you, you are not allowed to benefit from that malacha on Shabbos. Example, if a room is dark, I am not allowed to ask him to turn on the light. I'll talk about hinting in a moment. Okay, number two, if he turned on the light by himself without me asking, so it depends. If he did it for himself, I am allowed to benefit. I can read in that room. If he did it for me, even if I didn't ask him, I am not allowed to benefit, meaning I cannot read in that room unless there was enough natural light that I would have been able to read. So even though it's easier for me, I can do that. But if it was pitch dark and he turned on a light, I cannot do anything in that room. These are two different rabbinic prohibitions. Prohibition number one, to ask. Prohibition number two, to benefit. Now, let me just explain. This is why hinting will often not work very much. People say, well, what if I don't ask him? I don't say, do this for me. But I just hint. Now, hinting would be something like, I describe my predicament. I say, you know, it's very dark in this room, and it's hard to read. And the guy says, oh, would you like me to turn on the light? Now, you're not allowed to say yes. You then say, well, do whatever you want. But you have to understand, you still have a problem here. Because even though you didn't ask, and I acknowledge you didn't ask, you did not transgress. Hinting is not a transgression of asking. Right? You weren't over on that. But you still can't use the light because he did it for you. You see? Now, a way that could work is the following. You try to hint in a way that the guy is doing it for himself. Like you might say something like this. You might say, let's say refrigerator is a good example. Let's say you have a refrigerator that you didn't unscrew the light. Right? So when you open the refrigerator door, the light is going to turn on. So you can't open the refrigerator, and you might not be able, and I can't ask the guy directly to open the refrigerator, but I could say, oh, I forgot to unscrew the refrigerator light bulb, and you know, I'm not allowed to open it on Shabbos. I don't know what to do. And the guy says, well, can I help you? I say, well, you know, do what you want. There is a nice piece of gefilte fish for you. In the refrigerator. Okay, you have to pay. Or cholent, or Yerushalmi kugel, or chicken, or whatever the guy likes. Now, there, you understand what's going on. Number one, you didn't ask him. You only hinted. Number two, he opened it for himself, not for you. So that would be something. But the point I'm making is, hinting alone does not work if the guy is doing it for you.
But as long as he's benefiting.
As long as
even if you're benefiting.
That's correct. As long as he's doing it for himself. That's
especially
correct.
If it's going to help keep you from doing
break, like, oh, you know.
Well, yeah. Now things get more and more complicated. This is a very complicated situation because there are cases where the rabbinic prohibition simply doesn't apply, meaning there are cases where the rabbi said it's mutter. For example, if it's the winter and your heat breaks down and you have young children in the house, maybe if you don't have young children. So that's simply, Chazal simply recognized that when it's cold in the winter, people might get sick. It doesn't have to be life-threatening. To violate a Torah law would have to be life-threatening. But even if this is just, you know, colds and flus. So the Chachamim said, I don't even have to hint. I can ask a guy directly, please fix the heat. Because when it could cause sickness, I don't mean life-threatening sickness. Even if it's non-life-threatening sickness, the Chachamim said it is permitted. Now, an interesting shaila is, if I could ask a guy to fix the heat, could I ask a guy to fix the air conditioning in the summer? Not so simple. You know, people get sick from the cold. They get uncomfortable from the heat.
Heat stroke. Huh?
Well, okay, I understand. If it's an extreme situation, that's for sure. But I'm talking about a general situation where, you know, you're uncomfortable. You can be very uncomfortable. And I'll say that myself. I'm a person that has air conditioning even during the winter. I mean, I literally never have heat at all. So to me, it's not an issue. Of course, my wife is different. Okay, that's a recurring issue with this. But the thing is, so I'm declaring something against my own self-interest. But there is a very clear chiluk in halacha between fixing the heat, which is considered to be necessary to prevent sickness, and fixing the air conditioning, which may not be permitted, but when it's a large gathering like a shul, maybe it's permitted because it's for the benefit of a whole seaboard. So the point I'm making is the prohibition is complicated and the heterim are complicated. But what you need to know is that is not included in the Ten Commandments. Meaning telling a guy is a rabbinic prohibition. The Torah is only prohibiting making your slave work on Shabbos. It is not referring to a stam non-Jew. A stam non-Jew is a drabanya.
Yeah. So I've just got a situational question. So
yep.
What my family does is we get people before Friday night dinner, or we turn on the outside lights before Shabbos. And then, you know, we tell my friend who lives down the road earlier in the week to come by in the morning and turn it off. But we don't tell him to do it on Shabbos. Is that okay?
I'm sorry, when you say you don't tell him to do it on Shabbos, I mean...
We tell him earlier in the week.
Okay, so that's an interesting question. Generally speaking, the prohibition of telling a guy to do something on Shabbos is even if you tell him before Shabbos, if he's told to do it on Shabbos. Now, if you were to leave the scheduling up to him, for example, let's say you were to say on Thursday, you know, I'm going away for 2 weeks, I want you to turn the lights on and off every, you know, 48 hours or something. And the guy has a schedule in his discretion, Shabbos or not, that's going to be okay. An example would be, let's say you give your car into a mechanic to be repaired. Or you give your dry cleaning to a cleaner. Now, they may do it over, even if they're goyim, let's say it's in America, they're non-Jews. They may fix your car on Shabbos, they may dry clean your clothes on Shabbos, but since you didn't tell them to do it on Shabbos, that was their decision, so that's a permissible arrangement. But if you were to give your wedding dress, let's say, in late Friday afternoon and say that I need it Sunday morning, assuming they're open on Sunday, so you're giving them a timetable which requires that they do it on Shabbos, not allowed to do that. You see the difference. That's why you can send mail. I can send overseas mail even though it's going to be handled on Shabbos. But I cannot do Federal Express with a 2-day delivery which forces them to do it on Shabbos. So that's also a very important distinction. If they're doing it on Shabbos, but it's not because of your request, then it's not your responsibility. But you can't schedule it, even though you're doing it before Shabbos, in a way that's going to force them to violate Shabbos.
This is expressed I've had a couple times here in Yerushalayim, that it's usually the people who are working in houses that are the only goyim around. So you go, and they know as soon as you walk up to them in this kind of way, like, you come up, and you don't have to say anything and say, what do you need?
Right, they know, right.
And so I it's almost, for me, a little harder than with the person who doesn't know, because then they say, what do you need from me? And I say, just follow me. You know, like, how do you, what's the,
well, it depends. Once again, if you have criterion because of sickness and the like, you don't need to beat around the bush. You can specifically say what you need. If you don't, then you're in trouble, because even if they're doing it on their own, even hinting is not going to help for a lot of things.
Like, for a Kiruv trip, the lights were out on the balcony in the old city. So I went to the claimants, and they have some people working there, and I asked them, and they said, and as soon as they saw us come in, they said, give us a minute, we'll be over. And they
came
and did it, not for herself. We couldn't even say to do it for herself. It was like...
Yeah, okay, well, again, when you're dealing with the whole group, there are heterim for tzibur, right? So again, I'm not going to give you a whole share in this today, but just be aware that the iser is complicated and the heter is complicated. But I guess the only modest point I wanted to make today is this is not a Torah law. This is a subset of special rabbinic prohibitions, and because they are rabbinic prohibitions, they are sometimes waived in cases of difficulty, sickness, even if it's not life-threatening, and the needs of a congregation. So even turning on the lights, if you're in a shul, let's say even our Semech Beis Medrash, and the lights went out Friday night. Now, asking a guy to turn on a light is the prototype of what is forbidden normally. But for the benefit of a whole congregation, you are allowed, you don't have to hint, you don't even have to hint. You can actually ask the guy, fix the lights. But that wouldn't be the same in your house. Right? What can be done for a congregation is not the same as what could be done for individual people. So you can't generalize. You can't say, oh, last week in the Beis Medrash, they had a guy, you know, turn on the lights, so I can ask a guy to turn on my light. Not the same thing. There's a difference between a tzibur and a yachid. Of course, what is a tzibur? 10? 100? Yeah, okay. Like, when do you have the definition of a tzibur and the like? Okay. Yeah.
Quick question. You said we can't benefit... if he did it for me, we can't benefit.
If he did it for a Jew, right.
Yeah, if he did it for himself, we can.
Yes.
So how do you know if he turns on a light, if what's going on in his mind, if you want to read a book, if he's doing it for us or he's doing it for himself?
Well, if you don't know, you got to be strict. But sometimes you can see, for example, let's say the guy is sweeping around the room. So he turned on the light, so you see that although he's sweeping for you, but he's turning on the light so he can do his job. So you can sometimes tell he's reading, you know, whatever it would be, you know, different. You have to try to figure it out. If you don't know, you have to be strict, but sometimes you can figure it out. Yeah.
Just, this is about slavery. I was reading last week's parasha, and it seemed a bit problematic. About if you're a Jewish slave, you get to marry like a non-Jewish woman, have children with her.
That's right. That's
and
amazing.
Then you sort of abandon them when you become free. It seems a bit.
Yeah. Now this is this is not the slave we're talking about. This is talking about a Jewish slave. Now, a Jewish slave is a Jew, not a non-Jew that went to the mikveh and had a bris. A Jewish slave is a regular Jew. How does a Jewish slave become a slave? To digress for a moment, okay? Right? So there are two ways. Either he sells himself into slavery because of poverty. He just decides to sell himself because that way he gets supported for 6 years. Or if he stole and didn't have money to make restitution, he could be sold into slavery with the proceeds going to the victim of the theft. Now please be sure, do not confuse this with debtor's prison. If I owe money and I didn't pay, I do not get sold into slavery. You don't get sold into slavery because you owe, because you didn't pay a debt. But if you stole, that's different. If you stole, alright. Now, a Jewish slave is not really a slave in any meaningful way. In fact, the Gemara says in Maseches Kedushin, he who buys a Jewish slave has bought a master, not a slave. If you only have one good pillow, it goes to the slave. If you have a good bed and not such a good bed, the slave gets the better bed. Slave gets the better food. You have to treat the slave better than you treat yourself. So really, in fact, the Gemara even gives a story about, this was a story about a non-Jewish slave. It talks about the fact that people would often make slaves look healthier than they really were. They would dye their beards and the like. So it mentions one of the Amoraim bought a slave, and he asked the slave to clean up or something. And the slave washed the dye out of his beard and said, "I'm older than your father. You're telling me to, you know, do stuff for you?" So basically the Amora didn't ask the slave to do anything. He had the slave around, but he says he couldn't. He couldn't. The slave was older than his father, whatever it was. But okay. But a Jewish slave really is a worker. But he really lives very, very well. Now, the only thing that differentiates a Jewish slave from a regular Jew is this one halacha, that the master is permitted to have him live with a non-Jewish Canaanite slave. And if there are children, those children become non-Jewish slaves based on the mother. And then when the man goes free after 6 years, those kids do remain. That is a little bit harsh, but all I would say is that essentially the children were born goyim, right? They were born non-Jews. So really, really, halachically, this Jewish man was cohabiting with a non-Jewish woman, and therefore they're not really his children.
It was halachically permissible for him to have relations.
Yes, that's the one. That's the one exception to the rule. Normally, it's very prohibited, but in the case of a Jewish slave, this is what the master is allowed to do.
So why is it not prohibited in this case? But it's always
well, it's because that's part of. In other words, but since you own the person as a slave, the Torah gives you a certain power. I mean, that's an incident of slavery.
When he leaves, he basically divorces. I mean, there's no condition in the first place.
Yeah, you don't need a get. You don't need a get. You don't need
to. So just leave. Fine.
Yeah, that's correct. That's correct. Yeah.
Well, then couldn't a slave owner not just kind of cheat the system a little bit by buying a Jewish slave, getting him to have kids with a Canaanite slave?
Yes.
Or a Jewish slave. And then set the guy free when she's pregnant.
100%, 100%. No problem with that at all. You can use the, I don't know about the ultimate morality of it, but you can use the Jewish slave as a breeder.
Wow, okay.
Yeah.
So this concept of being able to use the Jewish slave as a breeder,
yep.
To me, it sounds like the halacha of during times of war where a man is now permitted to take a woman because of, say, emotional desires. Why is this halacha allowed? Is it for the similar reasons that the time of war that is allowed as well?
Well, it's hard to see the exact connection because in time of war, the idea was that passions were so high that if the Torah would say no, people would do it anyway. Yeah. So the Torah gave you a concession. Now, you could say that overall, that's the general approach to slavery. The Torah is not saying slavery is good. But in the ancient world, slavery was common. And if God were to say no, people would go into those systems and have slavery that was much more inhumane. So in a sense, the Torah sometimes permits the lesser of two evils, even though it recognizes it is not the ultimate good. That would be a general approach to slavery, and that might include that as well, even though you don't really have the same time of war situation. Okay, we'll stop here. Have a good day.
Thank you.